Welcome to the Breakout Growth Podcast, where Sean Ellis and Ethan Garr interview leaders from the world's fastest-growing companies to get to the heart of what's really driving their growth. And now, here are your hosts, Sean Ellis and Ethan Garr.
Right, in this week's episode of the Breakout Growth Podcast, Ethan Garr and I chat with Tony Beltramelli, co-founder and CEO of Wizard. And so if you're trying to find it, it's the word wizard, but instead of a W, it's spelled with a U in the beginning. So that's a little bit confusing, but hey, it keeps things interesting. Okay, so this company is at a really fun stage. It's my favorite stage in a startup. They're just seeing the puzzle pieces come together. It's manifesting in an excellent growth curve, and you could just feel his enthusiasm throughout the conversation.
Yeah, definitely. This is a super fun discussion.
Yeah. And I mean, part of that is that he really loves his product, but the part of the mistakes that he's made along the way too is sometimes too much love for the product where you're not paying attention to the audience as much. But let's talk a bit about the product. So imagine being able to scan a hand-drawn sketch or drag and drop design elements on a graphical user interface to quickly create designs for your website, mobile app, or software product. So Wizard does this by using AI and other technologies. And that means that non-designers on product marketing and growth teams can bring their ideas to life. So it's a bit like Canva and, you know, how Canva allows mortals to quickly make marketing materials that look like they were professionally designed. But these guys are doing it in product design. So what got us excited about speaking to Tony was this really honest and heartfelt LinkedIn post where he started to share some of the things that we talk about in this conversation with Tony. So Ethan, you want to tell our listeners a bit about this post?
Sure. Tony started that post by saying that 2021 was a wild year for him and his team. I think it was wild for everybody. And he shared this graph. It was a hockey stick growth chart, which might as well have been just straight up and down and not very much to the right. I mean, it was the growth curve all of us would dream about. But his post wasn't braggy at all. In fact, what Tony was really explaining was that getting it right meant getting a lot of things wrong first and learning from it. And you know, what was cool is he put your product market fit question into action and really homed in on not only what the must-have experience was for the Wizard users, but really on understanding it in a way that would help him and his team use that information to make really smart and good decisions along the way. And you know, so deeply understanding product market fit and measuring it consistently, which is something you and I have been talking about a lot, turned out to be the confidence booster that he and his team needed to transition to and drive Breakout Growth success. And that, again, really ties into the themes you and I have been discussing, especially in our growth snacks of late.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you again for correcting him. And he had attributed my product market fit question to someone else. So it's really funny that when we're interviewing him and he's talking about this great question that he learned from this other person, it was cool to see that it's really become something that has grown beyond me to where lots of people are using it. And so
That question helped me. So I feel like I owe it to you to give you all the credit in the world for that one.
Right. No, I appreciate it. And how he used it was amazing. So I was super stoked, not just to hear about the PMF survey, but how he's applied hacking growth and both of these together are writing this super exciting chapter for Wizard. And they're taking these concepts that it's easy to read about something, but to actually put them into action to drive value in your business and to drive success in your business, that's where it's really hard. And so he deserves all the credit in the world for that. And so particularly the stage that they're at right now, where it looks like they've really dialed in product market fit and now transitioning to growth through that initial growth inflection. That's an area that I've spent a lot of time focused on over the years and really developed a playbook where I can go into a company pretty quickly and work through the different areas to really crank that growth curve and kind of get them to the point where they can think about growth in the longer term over time, but figure out those initial channels. And so these guys have done a really good job to dial in that really understanding the product market fit and building the initial growth curve off of that product market fit. So it can definitely improve the odds quite a bit when you execute well through that area and get you kind of on a faster growth curve more quickly. But Tony's experience really shows how these tools and concepts can make the transition to growth more manageable, but it's also equally important to understand how to operationalize growth, particularly on the back end of figuring out how to drive it in the first place. And that's an area where you've spent a lot of time. So while I may be focusing on the transition, you've focused a lot more on operationalizing growth and helping a lot of companies in that area recently and with some really good success.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I've tried. But, you know, if I've learned anything along the way, it's that operationalizing growth or trying to operationalize growth too early before you've really dialed in all those things that you work on in the transition is really just it's folly. I mean, it ends up looking like a bunch of scattershot tactics and not really a solid plan. And that's an easy trap for companies to fall into. I think they do it all the time. So it sounds like Tony was kind of there until he started saying, we need to back up and really focus on some of these fundamentals. But, you know, his post starts with, what did we learn and what did we do differently? Which I think is just a great question we should all be asking ourselves all of the time. And a lot of it was about being intentional with speaking to customers, focusing on a really narrow, I think he said, awkward target, and learning to trust and use data. And I think, that's a good recipe for success for most every company.
Absolutely. This is a really great breakout growth success story. And I'm excited to see where he and Wizard kind of go from here.
Yeah.
I'm definitely a fan, and I think our audience will really appreciate this conversation, particularly those in earlier stage startups that are moving into growth. And you just really see the power of product market fit throughout this conversation. So Tony comes across as super genuine, and I get the feeling that he's creating a culture where employees are going to be just really stoked to be a part of that culture and make contributions in that culture.
Yeah, absolutely. And to that end, Tony told us offline that they are actively looking for growth engineers and marketing designers to join their team. So if anyone in our audience is interested in joining what seems like just a fantastic, cool company with really smart leadership, this could be a cool opportunity. So check it out or try to get in touch with us and we'll try to make a connection for you.
Absolutely. But for now, let's jump in and learn more about Wizard. And don't forget that we're now posting our episodes and the Growth Snacks on YouTube. So you can actually see Ethan and I, our funny looking mugs, do these things with our guests on video. And if you go and subscribe to the YouTube channel, I think you maybe get a little bit more out of it. Obviously, if you want to listen to this podcast and take a walk or drive in your car, we don't recommend video for that, but if you're sitting in front of a computer, that's maybe a more fun way to take in some of these conversations.
All right, let's do it.
Great. Hi, Tony. Welcome to the Breakout Growth Podcast.
Hi, gentlemen. Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, we are excited to have you here. And I'm joined by my co-host, Ethan Garr. Hey, Ethan.
Hey, Sean. Hey, Tony. Good to see you here.
Yeah. So I am really looking forward to digging into the business. You made a post on LinkedIn recently that really jumped out when we saw this incredible growth curve that you have. And you were able to highlight a couple of things that help drive the inflection point in the business. So we're excited to dig into that. But really, even before we do that, it would be great if maybe give us a little bit of context on what how to pronounce the name of the business, and then you know what it's all about.
You know what? I like to say that our name choice is our best and worst decision because people don't know how to pronounce it, but because of that, they often tend to remember the name better. But yeah. Anyway, the company is called Wizard with a U as a first letter instead of a W.
Okay.
And we are a product design tool for non-designers. So unlike Canva, which helps non-designers create, you know, marketing materials, social media posts, we help non-designers design mobile apps, websites, and softwares, software interfaces in general.
Awesome. And then can you give us a bit of context on the post that you put on LinkedIn that, it sounds like the growth that you've experienced in 2021 was incredible. So maybe not, we'll dig into more of it as we go in the conversation, but like a quick preview of maybe what was behind the key inflection in the business.
Yeah, of course. So 2021 has been absolutely wild, to say the least. We launched out of beta after a long process of iteration optimization, and we've seen like explosive growth, as you described. And we've learned a ton. And honestly, some of the learning that I'm sure we'll dig into were pretty simple, you know, after the fact.
Yeah.
Speak to customers, stick to an awkward, narrow target market, and then look and trust your data. That's probably one of the three most important takeaway.
Cool. Would you say that there was something, whether it was it your team or the culture or systems, that really allowed you to see and seize this opportunity? Or was like, did something change that allowed you to capitalize? Or was it just, this was the natural progression?
That's a good question. Well, first of all, when we started optimizing our product, we also realized there was a lot of things that we were not doing right. And as a technical founder, it feels frustrated that you couldn't just fix it with code. You couldn't just fix it by just, you know, writing a better algorithm. And I guess like discovering the hacking growth methods and putting it side to side with another method, which is often called the product market fit engine, developed by Rahul Vora at Superhuman. And then using those two when we're like, you know, trying to figure out exactly what we're doing, I think it's the biggest lever that allow us to just change the mindset of the entire team and just, you know, move the needle as fast as we could.
So there wasn't something like that you felt like was really in the way of you finding the success at the time. It was just about sort of iterating your way to the right processes and approach to get you there.
Exactly. I think we were all like very junior, first-time founders, assuming we could just build a product and then magic things would happen. And then we just realized, hey, no, we need to just put some process in the way we change the product. It's just not like, hey, we have a great idea, let's do this, customer are going to love it. No, there need to be a process. And for us, it took us a long time to realize the value of processes and the value of actually having mindfulness in the way you do things instead of just hacking things and hoping for the best.
Right. So when you referenced Rahul's product market fit engine, what were some of the things that specifically what you found most helpful in the approach that he's advocating?
I guess what we like the most is being able to have one KPI to look at, because you are an early stage startup. What is your North Star KPI, right? Should it be monthly active users, I don't know, number of templates? It's really hard to tell when you don't even know where the business is going to evolve, right? And so I guess this methodology makes sure we had one KPI and one KPI only to look at and optimize for, which was how many percentage of people would say that they would be very disappointed if they could no longer use the product. And this, because then suddenly you have focus and then you can optimize towards optimizing that number alone, and then figure out what your North KPI would be later. I guess discipline is pretty much what we got from that method.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's interesting. So Ethan has been using that approach for a long time. I know at,
Oh really?
Yeah. At RoboKiller. It was something that, you know, ultimately it was something that really helped Ethan and his team hone in on product market fit. So, Ethan, is that, did you find the same thing where it was just having that single metric to optimize on?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, that question, which you know, Sean actually wrote, so I always have to give him credit.
I say it.
Yeah, Sean
gives me credit for that as well. But yeah, I think he's actually added quite a bit to the process, so I really like his contributions as well. But go ahead.
But what I always liked about that question is that it's really that leading indicator of product market fit. So you know, actually, also something Sean's very involved in. The Go Practice simulator course really talks about how you measure product market fit. And I, you know, and the best measure, of course, is retention, but it's a lagging indicator. So I always loved that question because it was a leading indicator. And especially in those early phases for a company, when you're moving fast, you're iterating quickly, I think having that leading indicator that you can go back to constantly and say, how are we working against that metric is really helpful. And you're right. I mean, if you have 50 KPIs to look at, it's like looking at it, you might as well have nothing. It's just noise. So I think really focusing in on that North Star. And I always kind of say, like, until you have product market fit is your North Star metric. So yeah. Having that as your KPI, your main focus KPI, it's really useful. And yeah, once we had our first iteration of the product, we asked customers that question. And, you know, I was really encouraged because I think the number was probably in like the 20% range, said they would be very disappointed. And I thought, well, if it was 5%, then we have to change everything. But at 20%, like there are some people who are saying this is a must-have experience for me. How do we get that to the next level? And we were fortunate, it moved quickly. I mean, we had a right product at the right place in the right time, but it moved quickly. And
I think that's the market part of product market fit.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So no, it's really great that you're able to use that question to really drive growth.
Yeah. So Tony, would you say that the biggest driver of that inflection then was actually getting product market fit right, and then that allowed you to start focusing on scale, or what role did product market fit actually play in that inflection?
I guess this was like it gave us the confidence that the product was good enough for prime time, essentially. And then if it was good enough for prime time, then we could grow. Then we could actually start, you know, going a bit more crazy in the iteration, experimentation. And so, because before you have this confidence, you know, I know people always like to say, if you don't feel awkward about your launch, you launch too late, right?
Right, but right.
You also need to make sure you don't like disappoint people too much on your first go to market.
Yeah, so they never want to look at you again.
Yeah, exactly. So it provides the confidence to just say, hey, it's time to go out of private beta. This is ready for prime time. And of course, we failed in different other ways, but sure. At least it gave us that confidence.
Do you remember what the starting number was the first time that you ran the survey on what percentage would be very disappointed?
We were at 27% on the first run.
Okay. That's a pretty good opening gambit. As Ethan was saying, I think his team was around 20% when they started. And then what was there something in that 27% that they revealed about their experience with the product that helped you really hone in on how to make it better?
I think what really, you know, hit us in the face when we start looking at data and doing it on a more regular basis is that we had found a needle in the haystack. As in, when we started building this company, we thought we were going to be the target customer, like developer, designer, working better together, that kind of stuff. And so we fell in this Henry Ford trap, like we know better what to build because this is for us. But then nothing happened. Users were not active. Retention was really bad. And so using this method really showed us like, hey, the minority of our customer, which are non-designers, non-developers, are actually the one getting value. What's going on here? And then tailoring the product towards these people, it really what enabled the product to become actually useful even more to even the rest at some point.
Gotcha. So the big insight revealed from the early surveys was the who really needs this thing.
Pretty much, yeah. Which awesome. Is also why we also realized speaking to customers is really overlooked often.
Right.
Yeah, you want to just keep looking at data and just try to find answers that might not be even there.
Yeah, because once you identify the who, then the conversations with customers, you're not going out and talking with every potential customer. You start to really figure out the profile of, okay, these are the guys who really need this. Let's understand everything we can about these guys, and we start to identify who the market is. So that's awesome.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Ethan.
Yeah. I wanted to back up a second because one thing that I found interesting is you said we thought we would be the target customers, but I'm curious when you go back to the very beginning. I think you told us earlier that you know you started the business yourself even before it was a while before you had a team. But what made you actually think about building this product and going into this market? I mean, I was telling you earlier, I've been using a product with a client of mine called Balsamic. I've used other tools to wireframe and draw out products. I'm curious, what made you think that there was a need for this? Why did you start it in the first place?
We went through major pivots. So when the company started, actually, we didn't thought we're going to build, you know, an easy to use design tool. What we built back then was what I started working on was purely machine learning research, which was like, hey, can we just turn sketches and design into code to some extent? Like, can I sketch something out on a piece of paper and get something designed out of it? And so the thought was like, I'm a developer. I don't want to code the front end. Help me do that. And then that's why it started so much as a research project to just fix my own problem that it took us a long time to realize if it's so easy for a developer to just get from A to B, it can probably bring a lot more value to a non-developer and a non-designer. And this is really where things started to make sense, and you know, the pieces fit together, essentially. And so it took us a while between me alone and the team, because it's been going from research to actually realizing, hey, there's a product potential, and then assembling, you know, a co-founding team, and then moving forward to creating an actual product.
And it sounds like you said, like, talking to customers really helped accelerate that process. What was like the key what were the key questions you were asking your customers, or what were the key things you were surfacing in those conversations?
So one of the things that it's not so much about question, but we also try to just remove biases. When you're a founder, sometimes you tend to hear what you want to hear. And so what we also did when we spoke to customers is like, let the team, like the lead designer or engineers, just speak with customers themselves, because they will hear things differently. And so, I don't remember exactly what question we're asking, because we still run some of those survey, throughout face-to-face interviews or automatic surveys. We ask a lot often, and questions change depending on what we're digging for. But I guess the biggest value was really like, speak to customers, but get multiple people from your team to speak to customers, because it will highlight different things.
When you mentioned that in the post about getting other people on the team asking, you know, speaking to customers. And I always found that to be a real challenge, just because people are busy, and but the more you dig in with customers, the more, you know, the more you surface the learnings. But it's interesting that you say that, because one of the books that, I think Sean turned me on to years ago was The Startup Owner's Manual by Steve Blank. And he's really adamant that founders have to get out there and talk to customers directly. And I don't think what you're saying is saying you shouldn't do that. I think what you're saying is bring other people into that tent and you'll have even better results. So it's an interesting learning.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we've always heard like, hey, speak to customers. And of course we were doing it, but I guess we're not doing it enough. And we're not like ingesting those feedback in the product loop as much as we should have, I would say. Yeah.
Right. So once you started to feel like, okay, we've got the right product now, what was the first thing that you did when you decided, okay, let's start to scale this business?
So it's really trying to just leverage data. We nerdy founding team, we've collected a lot of data, and then how can we just put a process around this data to actually use it for something?
Mm-hmm. So can you give an example of the data that you're referring to?
Well, yeah, exactly. So product data, right? When people click on a, like the journey from sign up to becoming active, what button did they click? What kind of action did they take first? Did they actually use a pre-made template or went straight to create something from scratch? Basically all the usage data from the product itself.
Okay. So really like understanding, maybe working backwards from your most successful customers, what was the journey that they took to get to that experience?
Absolutely. And then this is pretty much the moment where we started speaking with other founders and learn about the hacking growth methods, which was, again, putting a process around data and then modify the product to just move KPIs, which was, again, for us, like a send god, so to say, mm-hmm. a godsend.
Yeah. So were you then focused on actually channels to reach those customers, or were you looking at more of a product-led growth approach?
Really much like a product-led. How can we just make that product as good as it can possibly get? And try not to create value once, but like, you know, multiple times to make sure that people get value over and over again. We haven't focused a lot on the channel part as of today.
Mm-hmm. So how do new users discover the product then?
Well, we have a lot of word of mouth because something I didn't mention, I mentioned briefly, since we have some of those like AI-driven magical features, often people will be mind blown and just take a video. And actually, one of the big channel has been really word of mouth for a while. And then, of course, growth through built into the product. But last summer, we were really surprised to see so many people finding us about Wizard from their kids seeing TikTok videos of people being mind blown by the features, which was and then the parents being like, hey, I can use this for my work.
So I actually, it's interesting that I saw a post yesterday on LinkedIn where somebody mentioned that they discovered kind of a feature in one of the Google products for kind of turning a sketch into a more of an icon type drawing. And like so many people chimed in and said, oh my God, this is amazing. And you know, so I kind of saw that in motion of what you're talking about. It sounds like you're doing something similar there, but in their case, they're maybe mapping more into kind of emojis and things that might be in chat where you actually have a probably a more valuable use case to businesses where they can turn a rough sketch into something that's a lot more actionable in product design.
Yeah, exactly. I think what people often are like mind blown is so we have one feature where, again, like as you said, you just sketch out some rough wireframe and the product will just automatically turn this into a design that you can use. And there is another one where you create something crappy because you're not a designer, and then you can just take a screenshot, upload it, and everything will be applied automatically. Like, hey, make my shitty design look like Twitter, and then things happen automatically. And people are pretty mind blown by this.
So how do you leverage that type of an insight to drive growth?
The tricky thing about word of mouth, as you guys know, is that it's really hard to measure. And if you can't measure it, you can't really optimize it, right?
So
I guess it's really trying to just shorten the discovery time from new users to that feature.
Perfect. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Essentially, if you know that feature drives a lot of buzz and word of mouth, then how do you get more people actually experiencing that feature to unlock that chain?
Precisely, yeah.
Yeah, because one thing I noticed a while back, Sean had Miro on the podcast, and I think Miro does this really great job of getting people to think about inviting collaborators onto that. And I noticed as I was using Wizard just yesterday that you're really focused on telling people, being really intentional and letting people know that the product is better when you work on it as a team. Have you dialed that in with those experiences? Like, hey, let's really trigger this when a user turns a sketch into a wireframe. Have you gotten to that level of sophistication where you're driving those, hey, you should share this or you should invite team members based on specific actions?
We've tried a few things, but we haven't seen a result where we could actually really drive like massive changes to team invite, for instance, by doing those like in-product triggers. So it's still pretty much like work in progress. And I guess the challenge as well is that there's so many different use cases, right? A solo founder is just creating something by himself or herself might not actually necessarily want to have the team come and just, you know, goof around with whatever they created. And so I guess it's really use case dependent where we see like this invite request being actually used and leveraging the growth loop that we want.
Interesting. And then let's take a little bit backwards again. And I mean, I think the thing that really jumped out to both Ethan and I was that growth curve that, you know, you've been, as we were talking about before, that you've been working on this since kind of mid 2018 in a more formal way. And even before that, informally, but just this year at one point, it just turns a corner. And it doesn't sound like you poured fuel on a fire of validation where you said, okay, we validated this thing. Let's start spending, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars getting the word out there. So something really happened with that spike. And I think as you said, you have the team's more engineering background and analytical. So I assume that you've probably really dug into to really trying to understand that spike. And so if you could really attribute that to just the most important factor in driving that spike, what would you say that it went into product market fit or is it something else?
That's a really good question. And yeah, you're absolutely right. We grow rapidly and we don't really understand all the variables yet. And as a matter of fact, we actually have hired a head of marketing, and she only joined like 3 weeks ago now. So until now, it's been really like, you know, product led. And I guess it's a combination of multiple things. As Ethan also said before, team invites started to being used more widely, but also like people embedding their Wizard design app on the web and then using those embedded prototype as again like a hook to just acquire new users. That has been also like, you know, helping a lot. So it's a bunch of different things that really like enable that the needle to move. And again, like word of mouth is just insanely powerful. The problem is, how can you just replicate it and scale it, right?
Right, right. So did you see a marked change in retention cohorts over time, like where, you know, in the beginning when you were starting on things, so it tends to like correlate closely with that survey question that we talked about, where in the beginning, after a month, maybe only 20% of the people who signed up are still using the product. But then later, when you start getting the right people onboarding in the right way, you get that up to 40% or 50%. Did you see those kinds of changes in the business? Or that's kind of hard to track as well. Did you even have the tracking in place to be able to see that?
We actually do, and what we see the different difference. And I think the difference is again like very dependent on use case. We started seeing like for example like product managers, product owners. This is like a place where we can definitely see a really, really long retention. While you have, you know, founders creating their first MVP and then they leave, they go fundraise or whatever, and then they come back only maybe a few quarters after. So this retention is really like dependent on use case, which is again something we've tried to double down. Because if use case is such a big variable that indicate retention, how can we also like incentivize people and mode the product, so to say, to their own use case? Which is obviously non-trivial because there's, you know, so many different things you can do, right?
Sure. Sure. And that's one of the things I learned at Dropbox is that there were so many different use cases. It could be a file share. It could be, you know, synchronizing my files across my own devices. And if you tried to communicate all of those use cases at once, people would get overwhelmed and say, man, this product sounds super confusing and complex. And so you had to spoon feed the right use case and then over time maybe introduce them to the full capabilities. But figuring out the right use case for each person is not always easy.
It's definitely not, especially when you definitely see that, hey, we could get traction here, there, and there. Which one do we go after first, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But I do think that if you can drive that retention, as we talked about, then the longer that you can retain people, the more likely that they have time to actually spread the word, to do some of those collaborative use cases, to discover some of the wow features that you've talked about. And so, and then on the other end, sometimes you have really viral products with no retention and they almost always just kind of peter out and die. So the powerful combination is retention multiplied by that virality and sharing. And it sounds like kind of both of those have happened. And to me, that's probably, from the outside, without looking at the data and just interpreting some of the things you're saying, it's that combination that's probably really critical behind that spike.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's always a combination of multiple things, right? I wish it was simpler often.
But it sounds like one of the reasons why you've been successful and you've been able to capitalize on these learnings and ride the spike is that you've really... really focused on testing and learning as quickly as possible. And I think it also in that post is very, we'll put a link to it in the show notes, but the post is really full of a lot of different things, but you really talked about high tempo testing and how that's been important for you. Can you tell us a little bit more about why you think testing quickly? And I think you said not focusing on quality of tests, but quantity of tests was really valuable for you.
Yeah, of course. And of course, there's a pitfall here because I think Sean wrote in the Hacking Growth book that, you know, the goal is not to also throw spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks, right? You also, quality still is important. But I guess it's really like the train of thought is you only want to start optimizing and perfecting solution that seems to be yielding good results. And when you are so early as a startup, you have limited resources. So you don't want to just over-engineer and over-optimize things that are actually not worth it. So that's why initially we've always tried to just optimize for quantity and velocity over quality. Of course, by still, you know, having some kind of mindfulness over what's still worth experimenting with, because otherwise you just get you release like very crappy solution as well. So it shouldn't be all random either.
Right. No, that's for sure. And I think sometimes people get so obsessed on on the quality that that they actually, you know, spend 4 months debating a test and then maybe eventually launch it. But, you know, they could have learned from 25 tests during that time. So it's really hard to predict exactly what's going to work and what's not going to work. But sort of holding yourself accountable to a consistent delivery of tests and within that target number, running the very best tests you possibly can run. I think that's the balance, but you don't want to over-index on just velocity or over-index on quality. You want to find that right balance of consistent learning and at the same time, getting those tests out the door and hopefully having some good ones in the mix.
I think the interesting thing there, Sean, though, is, because we've actually been talking a lot about that balance between high tempo and high quality. But I was curious, Tony, because I noticed your background is you started as a software engineer and then you were a data analyst. So do you think you're able to run tests at that velocity faster and more effectively because of your background and because you have that data analytics background to make sure that even if you're running them fast, you're getting good answers to your hypotheses?
That's a very good question. Honestly, I don't know. I would say, I've also met a lot of like growth people with a marketing background that were like super data driven, super number driven. So I'm not sure that having a technical background per se has been helping, although it definitely helped because we could actually just run our queries ourselves as technical founders and just, build stuff ourselves directly. And I think as an engineer, the reason why I said like this hacking growth method was a godsend is because we finally realized that we could optimize our company growth the same way we would optimize code, by using data and a clear method. But apart from that, I guess like any like number minded person would still, have the same advantage, so to say, at the
method. I'll give you my experience. It's always hard to kind of compare experience that you don't have, but what I can say, the one advantage of having the development skills in that early team as you're running the experiments is that, marketers can often come up with good ideas. And I'm not an engineer by background, so I'm more of that data-driven marketer type, but I still then have to convince engineers to implement a lot of the kind of the product led initiatives where, so there's some selling that takes place where if you have a team with those implementation capabilities, then, and the data driven and the creativity, then you can just sometimes move a little faster.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, I think you're right. And for a very long time, we've been only like, less than 15 in a team. So I guess you're right. This is probably where it really helped us because we could actually leverage the method, even though we're just a handful of people around the table.
Yeah. And then from a process perspective, trying to find that right balance of quality and quantity, did you kind of run the meeting process that we talk about in Hacking Growth, where it's kind of more of like a weekly meeting where you're processing the information? And did you use things like ICE scoring, or did you modify some of that a bit to something that felt more appropriate for your situation?
We're exactly doing what you said, like running weekly sprints. And then the scoring, we kind of like, we didn't want to overcomplicate things. So we were just like scoring on like complexity of implementation, potential impact on the KPI. And then we're just like summing those two. Very naive, but it works.
No, but that's really, that's the spirit behind the ICE score, is that you're really looking at, the most important are impact, as you just talked about, and then ease of implementation. The confidence is the only thing that you didn't reference there, but
no, we didn't.
The confidence is so hard to predict anyway. Like it's, a lot of times things that I've given a low confidence score to end up working and really providing a lot of impact. And then other things that you're sure are going to work, you try them and they don't work. And so, I think if you only had to pick two of the variables to optimize on, I think you picked the best two.
I'm glad to hear. I think we took confidence out because we realized like there was way too much discussion in those growth sprints about like, whether we were, confident.
Replace it was going to the move debate with a test and you'll learn more.
Actually, this is interesting. That's an interesting point. And Sean, a question kind of for you. Do you think that the, because you really championed ICE early, Do you think that confidence becomes a more important part of the discussion as teams grow? Because over time, first of all, there's a bigger backlog. There's more complexity. So debating that confidence in that becomes more of a factor over time.
Yeah, you know, there's one set of tests that I remember where we had a 90% drop off on a sign up, and we ran 10 tests. None of them moved the needle, and so our confidence was in the floor. You know, we're like, the next test is not going to work. But then the next test, we dug a little bit deeper. We did some qualitative research, uncovered why people are not downloading at a certain step, and then the next test actually gave us a 300% improvement on the download rate. So the test after that, the confidence score went way back up again, because it was more of a double down test where we had some new information and some new insights. And even before that test that gave us the tripling, our confidence went up quite a bit, because, you know, so I think a lot of times it's about diagnosing the problem that you're trying to solve. And when you uncover a great insight, whether it's through a qualitative insight or a quantitative insight or a combination, I think that can impact the confidence. And so I think that's probably an underappreciated part of that, is like, what role can research play? I mean, particularly in a startup in the early days where you have a pretty small sample size. And so if you can run some research that helps you contextualize an opportunity a lot more, or a problem a lot more, you're going to run better tests than just sort of, again, that spaghetti on the wall of just lots and lots of tests. One of the bigger risks there is that you start wasting, yeah, testing sample size that could have gone to something that could be more impactful on the business. And so a lot of times the big companies over index on too much research. But interestingly, I think it's the small companies that can often benefit more from the research, because it can help them direct those limited testing resources and limited sample sizes for those tests.
Such a challenge, though, to find that balance. I mean, I used to, you know, when Sean and I worked together 20 something years ago now, it's just dating ourselves a little bit, but I used to run in with my daily idea-ria and come in and say to Sean, "Hey, I got this great idea. What do you think?" And he'd be like, "Sounds good to me. Test it." You know, and I'd be like, "Can't you just tell me if it's going to be a good idea or not?" Okay, right. So it just doesn't work like that. So
I think where it really comes down to is it's what's the easiest, cheapest way to validate that idea. And sometimes it's through a test, and sometimes it's through, we think this is a good idea because we have this assumption that customers are confused about this. And so sometimes it's faster to actually run a usability test and see, are they in fact confused about this? And so it's really, what's the cheapest way to uncover the context is going to let you know if an idea is good or not. And often it's to run a test, but often it's a bit of research as well. So yeah, anyway, we better let you in on this conversation, Tony. Sorry.
I was going to say, I don't remember which partner at YC said that and which founder told me this, but you know, they have those weekly meeting at YC where they would meet the partners and just tell them like, "Hey, this is what we're trying to do." And apparently there is a story where they said like, "Hey, we need to do those three things. What do you think is the best? What should we do?" And then the partner look at them like, "Who do I know who do you think I am to know what's best? Just do everything."
Yeah, yeah.
And see what works.
Yeah. So are you a part of YC?
This is like just a reference to founders at YC.
I know they're doing a lot more in Europe these days, so that's why I thought maybe you guys were in there and I had missed that part. That's one of the things that I actually think is really cool is that you know, a lot of the knowledge that used to be really centralized in Silicon Valley has become a lot more widely dispersed with, you know, some organizations like Y Combinator and like First Round Capital and hopefully Ethan and I with this podcast really kind of take some of the best learning that's out there and make it more accessible to everyone around the world. So
absolutely. Cool. Yeah. We went to the interview over there and failed miserably when we were like in 2018, I think honestly, in retrospect, we had no clue what we're trying to build at the time. So that makes sense.
Yeah, but you know, it's one of those things too that, like, you know, they don't get everything right, and they get a lot wrong in terms of bets that don't pan out. And so just like the individual bets that we're making on tactical experiments, you know, that the investing is also still just a big guessing game. So
absolutely.
Yeah. So you're betting on people a lot of times there. But you know, I want to go back to, you talked about that you've now brought in a marketer to complement the efforts that you guys are doing. What was the profile that you were looking for? And why did you feel like a marketer would be a good addition to the team to help take you to the next level?
So one of my co-founder was the closest we had from a head of marketing for a long time, but he's of course doing a lot of other things. And we could see that, you know, the mindset that he had was really like moving the needle, because it was forcing us to just think from a distribution standpoint, a channel standpoint. And but when we hired a head of marketing, I guess the biggest important must have for us was being data driven. Someone that really can, you know, love crunching numbers and make sure that decisions are backed by data, and then, you know, optimize using data.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think especially when things are going well, that's one of the biggest risks in hiring a marketer, is that they come in and they break something. And so that was my fear when I went into Dropbox. I saw so much potential. I joined the week of coming out of private beta, and I just didn't want to break anything. You know, I didn't want to ruin this engine. And so I think I ran a survey every day for the first 60 days, like took the early users and broke them into smaller lists and then built really good tracking. And it just the idea of, you know, you have to understand before you try to drive too much improvement, or you can kind of break things. And so, I'm glad that you say that you were looking for someone who's really data driven, because that's the first step in understanding and then building on what's working, as opposed to, start making changes and actually break something that's working.
Break something. Yeah.
So with that product led approach and now bringing on a marketer, I think you've proven that it's hard to predict even a year from now. But if you think about a year from now, do you expect marketing for you to be very different? Or do you, like, in terms of what you're doing, the channels you're focused on? Or do you think it'll probably be more figuring out how to really continue to leverage those channels effectively?
That's a good question. Well, I guess until now, because we didn't have enough strong DNA in the team on the marketing side, we've tried things and collected data on what seems to be working, but we never done it to an academic level, so to say, right? So I guess the point of having a marketer is really like to really optimize and squeeze every bits we can of the channel instead of just, you know, scooping the first thing that we can grab on. I guess that's the goal here, really, like, and again, figure it out exactly what channel can bring predictable, like traffic and eventually active and paid users. So that's going to be probably the big focus for the next 18 months.
Tony, what that's from the marketing side. I think that's, you know, an interesting, you know, that makes sense. You'll see where it goes, but you'll probably double down on the channels more, you know, more deliberately. I was curious on the product side. You know, you said, you know, in 2018 you didn't even know where the product was going, and look where you are now. The product seems to have a very clear direction. And I know, sort of in this sort of world of wireframing and sort of the promise, or the dream, is that one day you'll be able to take your wireframe, press a button, and it'll become an app, right? And I don't know, I'm curious if with the product long term, do you see more of what you are today, or do you see, with your knowledge of AI and machine learning and what you can do, do you eventually see this becoming a more integrated solution from idea all the way to delivery?
That's a really good question. I guess the value we're really providing is the fact that design is really ubiquitous. Every company needs to design good software, otherwise they just lose customers. I have friends that routinely would choose a bank over another based on the quality of the mobile app and not based on the, you know, interest rate or fees or whatever. And so because more and more people need to design, the idea is really like to just empower all those non-designers to just be part of those, of making their product better and their offering better. And as you said, like Rano, we help them get turn their brainwaves into a design that can test and quickly iterate. But eventually, yeah, we would definitely like to imagine a world where they just go on the platform, turn their brainwave into something tangible, and then hit one button and it just hit the app store after a few hours. That's definitely a dream. But there's a few steps along the way to get there.
I know what I was going to ask before. The so the domain for the business, the wizard with a U, but IO as the domain name. I'm curious. So .com was not available. It's kind of a strange enough name. I was curious why you don't have .com.
We actually have .com. It just redirects to IO. So
gotcha. Oh, you do. Okay, good. Why would you go with IO over .com?
So we went for IO because we built this platform where you just take something from the real world and then it just digitizes it to the virtual world, so to say. So we thought like, okay, IO input output, that makes sense. But I guess we were a bit maybe too engineer heavy when we thought about.
Well, I'm glad you have the .com. So if you as your marketer comes in, that might be a good place to start having a conversation around what would. Yeah, you know, whether one directs to the other or either way, you're in good
shape. Absolutely,
we have the
.com ready for the IPO.
Perfect. So one question that we like to wrap up on, and as a regular listener of the podcast, I'm sure you know this question, but what do you feel like you understand about growth now that you may not have understood a year ago or before that?
It's really like company growth is similar to optimizing code, which again really appealed to me. And I guess the biggest learning is that in retrospect, we should probably have assembled a dedicated data team way earlier to make sure we could just move even faster.
Right. So I'm going to use that as an opportunity to plug a recent post that Ethan wrote, which really brings an engineering concept into growth. Do you want to give a quick highlight on that, Ethan?
Sure. I wrote a post, it's on breakoutgrowth.net, where I said, in growth, you should write the report before you run the experiment. And I stole that from an engineering lead at Teltech years ago. He said to me, he was telling me about test-driven development, where engineers like yourself write the test case before you write the code. And I always thought that's a great way. It has such great forcing functions in terms of writing high quality code that meets a set of requirements. So for growth, why not think about the result, get that in focus so that you're asking the right questions and you have the best chance of delivering on that. So it's just, I think it's an interesting way to approach this and maybe solve some of the challenges that companies face when experimenting quickly.
And that's an interesting approach, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it starts to highlight like the where engineering and development and growth it is really accessible. I don't think it's the exclusive domain of engineers to be in growth, but I think they bring a lot to the table when it comes to growth, just as marketers can bring a lot. And then the power comes when you kind of bring the best of both worlds there. One other thing, just based on your comment that I think is important is that And I'm guilty of this for a long time. I advocated that, data doesn't really matter until after you get to product market fit and you can kind of be more qualitatively driven up to that point. But I think through my work with Oleg on Go Practice, I've become a lot more appreciative of the role that data can play on that journey to product market fit. And particularly when you have off the shelf tools like an Amplitude that has a really generous free version that can allow you to at basically very little engineering cost and no financial cost to be able to get that visibility into retention cohorts and into segmenting what drives that retention. And you can start to make some of those discoveries that you talked about of like, oh, it's this user type that ultimately is long-term retained. And it's this is what the journey looks like that leads to that long-term retention. And those insights are really critical to not just getting to product market fit, but then scaling on top of it.
But I guess you also have a point though, because if you are really like a B2B, initially you might have almost no data because you have so little customers, you're selling, you know, massive deals. So then, you know, being a lot more qualitative makes sense. But I guess,
but I think even there, being able to find who are the five customers that are the most active, and let's work back for sure. from there. Like you don't need huge data sets to get really helpful insights from data.
That's absolutely true. Although I can't help think that there's so much more companies that have a B2C2B motion these days, and then data becomes so critical, right?
Yeah, and I think that's a big part of why they're moving in that direction, is something that Ethan and I have written about in the past, that a lot of the best B2B companies are really either modeling after B2C or even have a freemium component that give them the reach that then gives them the data so they can execute in a B2C type way. But we could go on and probably talk a lot more here. But this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing the journey. Ethan, any last words before we wrap up?
Yeah, I just want to say, Tony, I think your original post that got us excited about having this conversation with you, you're so generous in not only talking about, hey, we had this great spike and we're proud of it, but you really laid out a lot of the things, the mistakes or challenges you faced. And, coming from the engineering background and being a technical founder, I think you've pointed out some of the biases or errors that you may have made in the journey. But I think they're so useful for people listening because they're good mistakes to make. And I think, you know, the key is how you've responded and learned from them and really turned those into action. So congratulations on all the success. I think the product is fantastic and I'm really looking forward to seeing where you go with it.
Thank you so much for having me and thanks for the kind words.
Of course. And I think just to echo on Ethan, that post was amazing. Thank you for the transparency there. So much great learning. And so reminder, we will put that in the show notes. I'll link to that post. And I've got to assume that was your most popular LinkedIn post ever in terms of engagement.
It has been, yo. So thanks a lot for engaging with it.
Absolutely. No, that's awesome engagement that you had on there. So it just shows that there's a voracious appetite for that kind of learning from the trenches of someone who's going through it. So that's awesome. You took a step back to share that. So for everyone tuning in, thanks for listening. And again, thanks, Tony, for sharing your insights.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Breakout Growth Podcast. Please take a moment to leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. And while you're at it, subscribe so you never miss a show. Until next week.